Hello and welcome to Face to Face. I'm Jane Drury. I'm here today with Rosemary Stasek. Hello.
Good afternoon.
And I've caught up with Rosemary sort of en route from Kabul to San Francisco. Is that right? And she's dropped off to meet me at Cafe Perk. What is it? Central Perk, where we are. So we're outside. We've got horns hooting. And I think that's a parrot next door.
I think it is. It's adding that tropical feel to the afternoon.
Anyway, we're going to follow Rosemary's story. And Rosemary has set up a charity helping women and children in Afghanistan. And we'll hear a little bit more about that. So let's start with, take it right back, Rosemary, to where this all started, which I think was in California.
It did. It really all started on September 11th, I think, as so many things ended and started on September 11th. I was in office in Northern California in the San Francisco Bay Area. I was serving on the city council and as mayor of Mountain View, California. And that part of the country has the largest expat Afghan community. And after September 11th, the Afghan American community there was really under tremendous attention and pressure. And I started working with some incredible women in that community, talking about how they were going to be involved in their reconstruction and what things were impacting them with this transformation in Afghanistan. After the fall of the Taliban in late 2001, early 2002, these women began working in earnest and talking about returning to Afghanistan, and a reconstruction delegation was put together to return and begin looking at the issues. As a local politician, I was invited to join them. And you know, I really know that I was invited to go along as, you know, just a politician who, you know, really cared and was involved with the community. What I don't think was supposed to happen is I don't think I was supposed to fall in love with Afghanistan. And so, you know, after the time I spent there, I really was determined that I was going to stay involved. I came back to California after that visit, and I was still in office, but I started my own small nonprofit called A Little Help and began raising a little bit of money. And on legislative breaks over the next couple of years, I would go over, do a project, come home, raise some more money, do a project, come home, raise some more money. And the first project that I did was working in the women's prison. And one of the things that really struck me about working in Afghanistan at the time was how many women were falling through the cracks.
Yeah.
The big aid organizations were coming in at that point in 2002, 2003, USAID and the UN and DFID and all those folks were coming in. But there were groups of women who really were deemed to be not worthy of help. And the women in the prison fell into that category. So we did a project where we rehabbed the interior of the prison, gave them some windows and beds and curtains and made their life a little better.
Could you have got the women out of the prison? Was that an option you considered?
It was an option that was certainly available to us at the time, and sad to say even now. But 5 years ago, there was no rule of law in Afghanistan, and the women were in prison for nothing that we would consider a crime. They were in for what was considered moral offenses, primarily running away from home, either to marry someone that their family did not arrange, or running away from home to avoid marrying someone their family was arranging.
Yeah.
And we had about $5,000 to spend, and we could have bribed the release of all of those women out of the prison. And in fact, we did go to President Karzai and get the pardon of one 13-year-old girl who was in there. But the reality is for these women, it was their families who put them in prison, because
they had nowhere to go, really, did they?
The family felt dishonored. Mm. And the women who were in prison were the lucky ones. The unlucky ones were actually the victims of honor killings.
Yeah.
And so getting the women out of prison, putting them back to their families, was not the best solution.
No.
The best solution was really to make life a little more livable in prison for these women. So we did that. Again, a small, simple project for women who were really falling out of the mainstream of the big aid donors.
So that just made life more comfortable for them in the prisons.
And just something
beds,
as simple
curtains,
as that.
And gave them some privacy.
Exactly. And that really, I think, set the tone for all the projects we were going to do in the future. Small, simple projects at the grassroots level for women and girls who were not necessarily getting the attention of the big donors.
Yeah.
At the end of 2004, I was termed out of office. I'd been in office for 8 years. And so I'd spent the past few years going back and forth doing these great projects. And I decided, you know, it would be wonderful to, now that I was finished with my work in politics for the time being, to go over and spend a few months and be able to just spend the time I never got to spend before and work on projects I didn't have time to. And so at the end of 2004, I packed up my house in California, put everything in storage for a few months, and headed over to Kabul. And almost 3 years later, my stuff is still in storage, and I've been there ever since.
It's in your blood, isn't it? In your heart.
I think that Kabul is one of those places that either you will get off the plane and want to get back on in about 5 minutes, or something will get under your skin and in your heart, and you will find yourself very, very much embedded in the place. And that was my experience in Kabul. It's been home for me, and continuing working on our projects, we're always finding new things to do. It's always exciting, and we're always looking for places where we can do small, direct things for women.
And as an American woman in Afghanistan, do you feel personally in danger at different times? Or
I have never felt personally in danger. Kabul's a pretty artificial place in that there's about 5,000 peacekeepers in the city. So from that standpoint, it can be one of the safest cities in the world. On the other hand, it's dangerous in the sense that you may be in the wrong place at the wrong time. Over the past 5 years, there have been different dangers, targeted at different groups. Currently, the Taliban and the anti-government insurgents are really targeting government targets. They're targeting the police, the army, and the government buildings. And so to the extent that just an aid worker like myself might be in danger is simply a matter of being in the wrong place at the wrong time, being stuck in traffic near a military convoy when an IED explodes that's targeted at it. So I have to say that I don't feel personally targeted, but there is always the danger that you'll be, one of those famous collateral damage.
Yeah. And you talk about we, so you have a little band of merry women and you're all working full-time, or as this is a sort of project part-time basis? I mean, you must have to work there as well, I guess.
A Little Help is a completely voluntary organization. Yeah. No one from A Little Help takes a salary. We're really, really proud of the fact that every dirham that will come to A Little Help goes into our projects. And so we have volunteers really throughout the world now who do local events, local fundraisers, raise small amounts of money for us. We put it into our projects. Currently, to pay the rent in Afghanistan, because even in a place like Kabul, you do have to pay the rent.
Yes.
I have a wonderful contract that's funded by the U.S. military, and we're doing a project where we're training women police and army officers in emergency obstetrics. So we've been really, really fortunate. Now we've gotten a great project, one of those official, official projects where, we get a salary and can
Fantastic.
Pay the rent. But for on the A Little Help side, the money that we raise all goes into our projects, and it's we take great pride in that.
Yes. Yeah, no, it's really good. And I think there are so many worthwhile charities and sadly so many great causes. Oops, there goes the lorry. But sometimes it's difficult to know where to put your money. Is the money really reaching the people? So little projects like this, it's so nice, actually.
What we can really say to people is we aren't a big donor.
now?
You know, there are wonderful, wonderful organizations in Afghanistan doing major projects. We're not one of them. We're doing the small projects that touch a small number of women very directly. And I think that it's important that the large organizations get support for the big projects. But I think there's also a place for just a little group doing little projects.
Yeah, a little helping hand, in fact.
And that's really been our mission.
Yeah. So in terms of working with the local women, did you start with kind of handicraft projects? Have you taken that route at all?
We have been very focused on doing non-traditional projects with women out of the mainstream. It all started with the women at the prison. We look at women who are out of the mainstream either because of the way they're living their lives, for instance, working as police officers, army officers, women in prison, or women who are out of the mainstream, women and girls who are out of the mainstream because of where they're living. One of the things about Kabul is there are so many international organizations that sometimes it seems like everyone is sitting in each other's lap. Mm-hmm. And so we've had our focus now in trying to move outside of Kabul and find girls and women who are out of the mainstream geographically.
Yeah, in the villages.
Who are out of reach in the remote areas. Yeah. And that's why this year we've been doing so much work in Hoor province, which is one of the most remote provinces in the country.
And I suppose they must have problems with extremism. They're not as protected by the peacekeeping corps in Kabul, are they? So
every area has its own particular challenges. I think that the Taliban gets more credit than it deserves sometimes.
Yeah, possibly.
The Taliban is very, very active in the southern part of the country along the Pakistan border. But the rest of the country is suffering instability as well. And I think that I think at this point personally that the drug trade is much more of a destabilizing influence than the Taliban, because the drug trade really impacts the entire country, both the areas where the crop is grown, the areas where it's being processed, and the areas where it's being transported up through Central Asia on its way to Europe. And I would have to say, if you ask me what is the biggest challenge to Afghanistan security, it really, right now, it's the drug trade. There are also criminals. There are also warlords. There is a whole spectrum of people who stand to gain from the government not being in control. And I think it's too simplistic for people to always just be saying the Taliban, the Taliban, the Taliban, because then I don't think what needs to happen is being addressed. The reason that's so important to us is because when an area is insecure, the most direct victims are women and girls. When an area is deemed insecure, women's lives and girls' lives are impacted very, very personally and very directly. And that's why we care a lot about the security situation in Afghanistan, because it impacts the women and the girls we care about.
Okay. So what projects have you been doing over the last year or so directly for women and girls?
We had not in the past been involved in girls' education. Girls' education was one of those glamorous projects that everyone seemed to be enamored of. Laura Bush came to Afghanistan with her Girls' Education Initiative, and we were happy to leave that to the big players and go do our little projects. Unfortunately, what has been happening over the past couple years is both the Taliban and these various anti-government forces have really targeted education, and specifically girls' education, as a way to try and attack and weaken credibility and support for the government. And we've seen areas where donors are pulling out and are not as involved with girls' education as they should be. And we've seen that as a call, you know, our traditional call to say, okay, if others aren't going to be there, then it's time for us.
Yeah.
And so this year we've been involved in two provinces, in Hor province, as I mentioned, a remote area, and in Wardak province, which is right next to Kabul. It's practically a suburb of Kabul, but it is a very, very strong Taliban area. And we're building a girls' school just out of tents. Again, we don't have the money that the big folks have. We're putting up some tents in a small village in Wardak province. We're going to build a mud wall around it so the girls have a little bit of security, visual security. And we went out to do a site visit. They're building the wall. We went out to do a site visit, and the security situation was such that we all put our burqas on and went out there. And I have to say, I've never worn a burqa in Afghanistan before. Okay. And that's a pretty telling indictment of the situation now, that after 5 years, for the first time, I've pulled a burqa over my head.
Yeah. And you went for tents, rather. I guess it's, if you lose a school, if a school is bombed, then it's a vast investment that goes up. Whereas a tent, if a tent goes up in flames, you can put another one in, is it?
The most simple reason is we don't have the money to build a school. A school can cost between $50,000 and $100,000. We're not in that league. But yes, more in fitting with our, you know, the way we do things is we can buy a tent for about 850 dirham. Yes, we would hate to see that tent be burned down. We would hate to see something happen to that tent. But we can get a replacement inexpensively, we could get it quickly, we could get the girls back to school. Yeah. Whereas last year, about 350 schools were lost in anti-government violence. Those schools are still gone. Those kids still don't have a school, and we don't know when there will ever be the money to replace those schools. So again, we're in the mode of saying, you know what, yes, schools are wonderful, and every kid should have a school building, but for right now, if the option is having girls out in the open under a tree or under a tent, we're there to see if we can at least give them a tent to study under.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose it starts with books.
It all starts with books. It all starts with books. In many ways in Afghanistan, it starts with a place where the kids could gather with a teacher.
And feel safe.
And to feel, for parents, to feel safe. We've just, to add to all of this tragedy in Afghanistan, we just had an incident where there was a massacre outside of a girls' school. Terrorists came along on motorcycles with assault weapons and opened fire on the girls leaving school. Many of them were murdered, many were injured, and throughout the country, it really put fear in the hearts of parents who are dedicated to their girls' education. This happened in an area south of Kabul. I was out in Hor province, out in the western part, in a completely different part of the country. I showed up at one of the girls' schools we're working at, and there wasn't a girl in the school. And this was a week later. And we were told, you know, the families just don't feel safe yet sending their girls to school. I'm happy to say a few days later, when I went back to the school, there were a lot of girls there, and things were just as lively as usual. But there was a week and a half where families in a completely different part of the country with completely different circumstances felt that they needed to keep their daughters home. And again, these are parents who are dedicated to their daughter's education, and there are so many families like that.
It's understandable, though, isn't it? And so does it get to the point where you think it's not worth it? Where, you know, maybe the parents have to teach them at home, and it's just, this is too dangerous?
It's a decision, I think, that has to be made at the family level. The difference in Afghanistan is so many of the parents have not had the opportunity for education. This is a country that's been at war for 30 years. We have two generations who were refugees, both within Afghanistan, moving to avoid the violence, and refugees to Pakistan and Iran who didn't have access to education. So many of the parents we see that are very focused and dedicated to their daughter's education are themselves completely uneducated and illiterate. And so there wouldn't be the opportunity for homeschooling.
No.
And the only chance that their daughters have is with the one or two teachers there might be in the area.
And are you seeing girls coming through to, say, Kabul University?
One of the things that is has been really so energizing for me, because as you can imagine, there are plenty of days when you wake up and say, what am I doing here? You know, this is hopeless, this is frustrating, let me just pack it in. But the Taliban was in power for 5 years, and it took 5 years of girls' and women's lives. Women were out of the workforce for 5 years, women had no access to health care for 5 years, and girls had no access to education for 5 years. When I first came to Afghanistan in 2002, when school started for the first time in March of 2002, I visited classrooms for first and second grade where there were 12-year-old girls in that classroom. They were so determined to recapture those years that had been stolen from them. And even today, when I visit Kabul University, and I know so many young women in Kabul University, there are women in university who are in their mid-20s, their late 20s, because they, for these past 5 years, they have been determined now that they're going to recapture what was stolen from them, and they're going to finish their education. And I have to say that I look at them and really feel pretty small. and you know, when I get discouraged, I think of them and think,
they've battled their way through, haven't they?
What can I say when I look at these women? We just have to keep going.
And as these young women go through university, come out the other side, is there a place for them in developing this country? Are they able to work? Are they?
That's a very challenging situation. The job market in Afghanistan is so difficult in a post-conflict situation. Graduates of Kabul University, both men and women, have an enormous challenge of finding jobs in this economy. And that's an issue the government has really have to find a way to address. How do you build the private sector to absorb this talent that is coming out of the university? I think for those graduates, excuse me, who speak English, the international aid organizations are a great opportunity for them, but that's not sustainable.
No.
The day is going to come when the foreigners are going to leave Afghanistan again, as we have so many times in the past. And if the private sector isn't developed, then we will have, again, a whole generation of educated people who are dedicated to their country who will just have no opportunities.
So that's kind of where you came in, really, isn't it? Because they were in California. That's the first kind of group of people that you started with.
Yes.
Yeah. What about women's entrepreneurs? Is there a place for women to run their own small businesses?
There is really a focus on trying to develop women's business opportunities. The culture is, of course, among the most conservative still.
Yeah.
The government itself doesn't limit women's roles, but the culture and families still do. There are a lot of organizations doing the traditional handicraft projects, as you mentioned earlier, and there is a certain opportunity for that. The challenges to that are there's only so many handicrafts the international market can absorb.
And quality issues as well, yes?
Quality issues, transport issues, and issues about fairness to women.
Yeah.
One of the things that have always made me very frustrated about the handicraft projects is that women have so little control over the economic cycle. You know, they work their heart out making all these products, and then at the end of the day, they have to turn it over to a man to take it to market. And they end up getting what we wouldn't call a fair trade, fair trade market. And so from my standpoint, economic development, I think, needs to focus on sustainable things that have a sustainable market within Afghanistan, that don't depend on, you know, people who are willing to buy little embroidered things from Afghanistan. That's a very transitory, fleeting market.
What about women's, like, services? So traditional things like hairdressing or nails or henna or those sorts of things. Is that
the beauty industry has a very central
place. That's more succinctly put, actually, the beauty industry.
The beauty industry has a central place in Afghan culture. Mm. And there has been, you know, some activity in the Kabul Beauty School of training women and restarting and retraining women in that industry. That's a really unique area in that it is one of those areas where women have control over the whole economic cycle, mm-hmm. where their customers are women, the work environment is all women, they bargain with their customers, they collect their payment from their customers, and you don't have that, you know, you don't have that lack of control.
Yeah, the money's in their pocket.
The challenge in the beauty industry, however, is it has a reputation as being not an honorable profession for women.
Okay.
And the Taliban had closed all of the beauty parlors, saying that they were fronts for prostitution, which they were not.
Yeah.
But they still hold that certain stigma. But again, it just makes the women who are in it that much more determined, because so many of them are in it because they are determined to be able to provide for their families, and this is giving them an opportunity that they wouldn't otherwise have. So I think that what you'll see in this culture is you'll always see these places where women find themselves mm-hmm. out of the mainstream, and there are all kinds of examples of this.
Teaching and nursing, are they areas that women get involved?
Teaching and nursing are, I would say, two of the primary areas that women are involved if their families allow them to work.
Yes.
Again, it is a decision of the family, depending on the particular values of the family, whether girls will be educated, whether women will be allowed to work. Teachers and nurses are absolutely the two major mainstream women's occupations. The problem is those are primarily government jobs. Teachers are all employees of the Ministry of Education, unless they're in a small number of private schools. And nurses are primarily employees of the Ministry of Public Health, unless, again, they're in one of the growing number of private clinics. They make between $30 and $40 a month.
Right.
And in a city like Kabul, what I don't think people appreciate about Kabul is an incredibly expensive city. The cost of living in Kabul, for me, and I can just compare it in terms of my rent and my car and my gas and my food and all the things that, you know, you do day to day, my cost of living in Kabul is slightly more expensive than it was in California.
Wow.
This is not a cheap third world sort of place. And for someone to get paid $30 a month is not a viable profession, and what you find is that
they're still dependent.
It's not a way to make a living.
No, they're still dependent on their families.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, it's wonderful what you do, and of course we want to support you with the ongoing project, which is the girls' schools. So we were looking earlier at some of the pricing around that and the things how if people would like to donate. We have. For 100 dirhams, that would buy what we were looking at, 3 sets of books.
Yes.
Which, you know.
Yes. So three girls can get all the books they need for the year.
For a year's education. So I was just thinking, you know, because all of here in Dubai, a lot of us have got children going back in September, and we're buying bags and pencil cases and all of that for our own children. So when we met a month ago, I was thinking, well, this is a good tie-in for us right now. So let's just look at, you know, what we could do with a small donation and what you could do with that. So the books is an easy option for anybody who wants to just help you along a little bit. And then it was a desk. How much a desk?
A desk is about 175 dirham. We could buy a strong, sturdy desk that will last a long time, even in harsh conditions.
Yeah, great. And a tent.
A tent is 850 dirham.
And how many girls can we squeeze in a tent?
Well, you know, the ones we're buying are they're telling us they're for 50 students. But let me tell you, at the younger ages, they're fitting a lot more than that in it. And it's nothing fancy, but it's the difference between girls sitting on the ground out in the elements and the wind and the dust and the sun in you know, just under a shelter, it makes a tremendous difference in their ability to concentrate and the ability of the teacher to keep control of the class.
Great. Well, we're delighted to be supporting you with this, but of course, ongoing, this is your project right now, and I'm sure there's going to be something else in 6 months' time with you coming through again.
There never seems to be an end to the things that we find that we'd like to reach out and get involved in.
Oh, great. Well, you promised to come back and tell us more.
Absolutely. I'll love to keep you updated.
Okay. Thank you very much, Rosemary.
Thank you.
Thank you.